Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The 2004-2005 season opens this month with performances by singer Emmylou Harris, family entertainer Dan Zanes, the Baryshnikov Dance Foundation's Forbidden Christmas, and jazz masters Nancy Wilson and Ramsey Lewis. Visit KrannertCenter.com for information on the entire season. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Writer Kristen Henderson is a Quaker, a pacifist, married to a chaplain in the Navy. He shipped out with the Marines to Afghanistan after the terrorist attacks of September 11th. He has also served as a chaplain in Iraq. Kristen Henderson is the author of Driving by Moonlight, A Journey Through Love, War, and Infertility. The book is a memoir about a cross-country road trip with her dog, Rosie, in a vintage Corvette, while her husband is deployed in Afghanistan. His Marine battalion was among the first to leave for Afghanistan after September 11th. Driving by Moonlight is a story about life and love, about a solid but sometimes strained marriage. It's about her years-long attempt at having a child. It's also a story full of consideration of what it means to live a good life. Listeners, I invite you to join the conversation with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Our guest, Kristen Henderson, is a frequent contributor to The Washington Post. Her short fiction has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize. Her memoir, Driving by Moonlight, is available from Seal Press. That's an imprint of Avalon. And you'll find Kristen on the World Wide Web at www.kristenhenderson, and that's Kristen with a K, K-R-I-S-T-E-N, Henderson, Henderson with an O, H-E-N-D-E-R-S-O-N dot com. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Kristen Henderson, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure.
I have to start with one quick correction, and you're not alone in this, but
yeah.
My first name is actually spelled K-R-I-S-T-I-N.
Oh, okay.
Which normally I don't care about, but on the World Wide Web, it matters.
It does. It does. And you know what? It's because my handwriting is so bad here this afternoon.
Well, that's a much better excuse.
And I had scrawled it at the top of the page because I wanted to mention it.
It's no problem. I sure appreciate it.
Yeah. And I've got the book right here in front of me. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, how did you make a decision, this decision, that you would head out on the road?
Traveling across the country is something I had always wanted to do. I'd never driven west of Iowa, which is where my dad's family's from. Hadn't seen that part of the country at all, and I kept saying I was going to do it. And then, of course, you know, real life kept intervening and never did. And finally, in 2001, my husband was scheduled for a six-month deployment with the Marines in the fall. And I thought, well, that'll be the perfect time. He'll be gone 6 months floating around the Mediterranean, and I will take 6 weeks and drive across the country. And a week before he left, that was when September 11th happened. And so I thought, you know, I really probably should cancel my trip because, I mean, you remember what it was like. I didn't even know if I could get gas, if there would be more attacks. And by the time he left a week later, it was very clear that he was not going to just be floating around the Mediterranean. He was going to war. And this was really disturbing to me on several levels. Obviously, I was very concerned about him. But as you mentioned, I'm Quaker. I'm a pacifist. And when I looked at those pictures of Ground Zero in Manhattan, and when I looked at the Pentagon in my hometown of Washington, D.C., I, c- couldn't help feeling that war was the right response, which completely took everything I believed in and turned it on its head. So I was completely discombobulated by this. I was feeling a lot of anxiety, and I dealt with it like a grown-up. I ran away. I hugged my husband goodbye, put him on his ship in Norfolk, put the dog in the car, and hit the road. Because for me, you know, driving is escape. It's like meditation. And, you know, what better place to be than far away from your troubles?
Yeah. Early in the story, you're visiting a friend by the name of Mary. She's adopted a child. And you write about filling your life with certainty and purpose. I mean, and at this point in our history, I think that's something we were all thinking about. You know, what's happened? Why has it happened? And what's next? And filling one's life with certainty and purpose, one way to do that is with children. But, you know, that also seems, but you're full of uncertainty, maybe even about that idea.
Yeah, I had always really, really wanted a child. And, you know, as I was traveling across the country, at some point, you know, along the way, I was feeling very lucky to be able to, you know, have the freedom to take this trip and run away from my problems. But along the way, I started to realize the reason I had that freedom was because I had no children. And, you know, the dog that was traveling with me was a result of our attempts to have children. My German Shepherd, Rosie, was a consolation prize at one point after a particularly painful failure. And then when we finally gave up completely, the 1970 Corvette that I drive was another consolation prize, because that's a car I never would have bought if I had a child. And, you know, so here I was lucky enough to drive across the country in my beloved car and with my beloved dog because of my bad luck when it came to having children. And, you know, for me it really was bad luck, because I really wanted a baby. And we tried for almost 5 years, and that included almost 2 years of increasingly painful and expensive medical treatments. And at some point I asked myself, you know, why am I doing this to myself? You know, why do I keep trying? Why do I want this so badly? And I thought, you know, maybe if I could figure out why, then maybe I could give myself permission to let go.
Yeah.
But in the end, I just had to conclude that there really is no logical reason why. You know, the urge to make a baby is pretty primal. It's not, it doesn't lend itself to analysis by the intellectual parts of the brain. And, you know, at some point, it also occurred to me as I was driving along that we've been making wars for about as long as we've been making babies. And as I drove along, I started wondering, you know, if the urge to make war was any more stoppable than the urge to make a baby, because I certainly had a really hard time letting go of that, you know, baby-making urge.
Yeah. Well, in the book, I want to get to the idea behind the title of this book. You know, you're talking about children and war here, you know, within the same breath almost.
Mm-hmm.
You write, war too can fill you with certainty and purpose, even if all you do is wave the flag to support it or march at a demonstration to oppose it, the way I did on the eve of the Gulf War in 1991. But on the eve of this war in Afghanistan, the only thing I'm filled with is aimless uncertainty. I feel as if I'm in the vet at night with no headlights, and I can just barely see the road to find my way. I feel as if I'm driving by moonlight. When did you realize, you know, I'm driving by moonlight? You know, when did that metaphor
come to me? The actual metaphoric connection really kind of emerged over the course of the trip. I don't know there was any one moment. I certainly felt very lost and confused from the moment those planes hit the towers. And I think a lot of people felt that way. It shakes your principles. It tests everything you believe in, whether that's in the goodness of people or your sense of security or safety or, you know, in the possibility of preventing that sort of thing. And, you know, and that was why I took the trip, was to try and find some peace, at least inner peace. And by the end of the trip, I was in a much better place. I was much more peaceful, and that was why I sat down to try and write the book, was to try and understand how that had happened. And part of the reason it worked for me was, you know, it was just sort of this letting the road take you where it will, and beginning to realize that, you know, life is a road ahead of us that we don't always get to pick. The only thing we really can control to any degree is how we respond to that road. You know, whatever road we find ourselves on, whether that's, you know, in a country that's been attacked or, you know, in a life without children that you didn't expect to be living.
Hmm. So you thought you were running away, but really you were on a journey and you were headed towards something.
Yeah, although I didn't know what, you know, and I'm still not sure what. I mean, really, in this life, all you can do is, the only thing you know is what you look back at. We really don't know where we're headed.
Yeah. The second chapter in the book is titled, If Religion Were Cars. And you say, if Quakerism were a car, I could see it as a pacer.
A gray one, of course.
I don't know. As a Quaker woman, now you've had the vet.
I know. I've never said I'm a very good Quaker, but it is a dark blue vet. You know, it's not red or anything too flashy.
Yeah.
My childhood growing up, my father, his family's Quaker, and he pretty much walked away from that in his adulthood, and is an atheist. And my mom, he's very much sort of the rationalist. My mom is, I would call her a spiritual seeker, and through her I experienced a number of different religious paths growing up, and I'm really grateful for that experience because I was exposed to belief systems that I otherwise might be dismissive of today, and, you know, everything from transcendental meditation to, you know, good old Pentecostal hallelujah mm-hmm. tongue speaking, so kind of work the whole gamut. But as an adult, when I came back to a Quaker meeting, that was my earliest exposure to religion. And when I came back to it as an adult, I really felt like I had come home, that particular form of religious practice really clicked for me.
Yeah. Talk with us about why you are a Quaker.
Quakerism is it's hard to define because there are probably as many approaches to Quakerism as there are Quakers. It does not have a, it's more about the process than any in particular rules. It doesn't have a written doctrine the way a lot of other religious forms do. It has, you know, five principles that most Quakers can agree on, and those are simplicity, peace, integrity, community, and equality. And you know, basically Quakerism provides a framework for me to work through the big questions that life presents, and it doesn't tell me what the answer should be. And in fact, one of the things this trip taught me is that, you know, it's not the answer so much as asking the question and trying to find an answer.
Hmm. Kristen Henderson is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's a writer. We're talking with her this afternoon about her memoir, Driving by Moonlight, A Journey Through Love, War, and Infertility. Listeners, you can join the conversation this afternoon with the telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting for us on a cell phone on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi, my name is Mary. I was listening, and what intrigued me about the caller is that she's Quaker, and then her husband went to war, and I am conflict. I'm like her mother. I'm the spiritual seeker who's exposed my children to all different kinds of things, and I'm very against this war, and I'm feeling like the solution to terrorism and to what's going on in the world is not going to be war after war after war after war. And I'm wondering, you know, and with this administration, I'm confused about even who I'm going to vote for. I feel like I want to vote for Kerry just to get Bush out. But at the same time, you know, I'm confused about that. I pray about it. I'm, you know, using my sort of spirituality to kind of bring me to some peace. And I was intrigued at the fact that she said no matter, you know, regardless of how she was raised and how she meditated and the fact that she could just go off on the road, that she felt this war was right. So Is she still feeling that way is my question.
Okay. Yeah, and I think that we're talking about two different conflicts here. We're talking about the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I appreciate having you raising that question, Mary. Because I have to say, when I said goodbye to my husband when he left for Afghanistan, it felt very different from when I said goodbye to him when he left from Iraq. When he got back from Afghanistan, he was home 9 months, and then was turned around and went to Iraq. You know, and I think it comes back to that human sense of self-defense, and that was certainly what Afghanistan felt like. Whether or not our leaders, I don't feel like our leaders are following through in Afghanistan in the way that they promised. I feel like they're letting the Afghan people down terribly. And, you know, Iraq, we've seen...
sidetracked.
It definitely... you know, we're there, whether you agreed with going in there or not, we're there, and, you know, the planning was clearly wrong, and it's very hard. I try to focus really, and I think everyone who has someone in the military has this this dilemma, which is, you know, supporting the troops whether or not you support the conflict. And, you know, I'm very proud of my husband and his service. I'm proud of what he does to take care of people who need taking care of, you know, our men and women in uniform who have signed up to set aside a lot of their basic constitutional rights in order to secure ours. And, you know, anything I can do to support the people who are doing their duty, I'm there to do it. To me... that it's possible to separate that from my feelings about the war. And that's not true for everyone. I've been talking to a lot of military spouses in the last couple of months working on a new project and just in my, you know, daily life. And for some people, that separation is not possible. And, you know, I respect that position as well.
The other question I have is that you were writing your book. I also have considered writing a memoir, and it's based on my journey. But I feel like my journey isn't finished enough for me to write about it, or the conclusion isn't there. And it was so interesting that you said, well, you know, I don't know. You know, I felt this peace when I finished my, you know, car journey with the dog. And I could write at that point because I could look back and see what brought me to that place. And I feel like I'm still working to attain that peace, get it every once in a while, and go back into turmoil. And can I write the book while I'm in it, you know?
Oh, sure, because, I mean, I'm in a different place than I was when I finished the book, you know? I mean, it's just, all it does is capture where I was at that moment. And, you know, I attained some peace, but then, you know, I turned around and was faced with new challenges. So writing is a wonderful way to kind of work through what you're going through. And I think for any writer or any artist, if you are writing from a really being as truthful and open and honest as you possibly can, you're tapping into that, I don't know if you want to call it the collective unconscious or whatever, that that river that runs through us all. And, you know, truth emerges from that. And sometimes inner insights as well. And, you know, just writing the book was a real kind of eye-opening experience for me. Because I set out on this trip with the plan to write a book. That really didn't happen until afterward.
Well, it's so enjoyable. I'm on my way to Chicago from Cincinnati to help parents, and I was just listening, and I never know if I'm getting a rerun or I can really talk to the person. So it was my pleasure.
Well, it's been fun talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Not a rerun today, but who knows, we might rebroadcast this program on another day. The day we're doing this program with Kristen Henderson is September 1st of 2004. Our guest, Kristen Henderson. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Kristen is the author of Driving by Moonlight, A Journey Through Love, War, and Infertility. Well, talk with us about your husband. You call him Frank. How did you two meet?
We met back in college. He was assisting at a Lutheran church there. He was actually living at the church, and he was sort of the caretaker while he went to college. It was right across the street from the campus, and he was thinking he'd become a minister, so he was helping out on Sundays as well, which meant standing up in front with the minister and assisting during the service. And I was living at home with my parents and my grandparents, and my grandfather gave me his car. He was getting pretty elderly, and he just sold it to me for a dollar for the agreement that I drive him and my grandmother to church each Sunday. So that didn't seem like too high a price, so I drove them to church and sat there and saw this really cute guy assisting up front. And, you know, I was sort of a shy girl, so I just was enjoying watching him from afar. And what I didn't realize was that maybe I was watching him a little bit much, because there was a period in the service where everyone's heads bowed, the minister's praying, and my husband-to-be kind of peeked up to look out at the congregation to count how many people there were so he'd know how many wafers to put out for communion. And he saw a whole bunch of bowed heads and one pair of eyes, mine, looking back at him, and he winked at me, and I was absolutely mortified. And I swore I would never, ever speak to him. You know, I was just so embarrassed. And but he was curious about me, I guess, and I would park there at the church during the days when I was on campus at class or working, and he started locking up the parking lot, which forced me to come knock on his apartment door to be let out. So that was how we met.
Yeah, yeah. What led him to his calling as a minister, and then what led him to want to serve as a chaplain in the Navy?
Mm-hmm. Well, he had actually been, he'd always wanted to fly, and so he was at Navy ROTC during college. And color vision, that's what it was. He had color vision problems, so he turned out he wasn't able to fly, but he really found a home as a Marine officer candidate, and had planned to become an artillery officer when he graduated. And just before being commissioned, he developed a health problem that led to a medical discharge. So his family was always kind of disengaged, shall we say, so he really had found a home, you know, kind of a family home with his fellow Marines, and he missed that. And he also missed, I think, the sense of service and that what you're doing is worthwhile and important to your country that comes with military service. And so, you know, since service was something that was attractive to him, he wound up going into the ministry. But really felt like, you know, his home was in the military. And so when he was 40 years old, an opportunity came up for him to go back into the military as a Navy chaplain. And the Marines, as a part of the Department of the Navy, use Navy chaplains and doctors. And so he has served a good part of his time with the Marines as well as in the Navy.
Hmm. Most of the people in the service are so young, you know, barely just out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
How does Frank talk with young Marines and sailors?
Most of what he does is not actually directly religious. You know, religious services and that sort of thing, Bible studies are probably the smallest part of his job. Most of his job is as a, I guess, something like a social worker, you know, mentoring and guiding people through some pretty tumultuous years of their lives. And like you said, most of them are very young. You know, if, for instance, when they were in Iraq, or actually in Kuwait, waiting to cross over the line into Iraq before the invasion, he'd have people, you know, not just 18-year-olds, but, you know, people in their 20s, 30s, you know, sergeants coming to him saying, chaps, I mean, that's the nickname for chaplains in the Navy, you know, chaps, I'm having these nightmares, I can't sleep, you know, and he'll talk with them about it and help them work through that. You know, for instance, in one case, the guy was just afraid that he was going to let his buddies down and do the wrong thing. And after talking with Frank and kind of processing through all that, he came back to him the next day and said, "Oh, I had the best night's sleep I've had in a long time." And that actually tends to be one of the biggest fears that they have before going into combat, is the fear of letting down their buddies.
Mm.
Or the other fear is of killing civilians. That's the other major fear.
Who does Frank talk to?
Mm.
I mean, who do the chaps talk to?
Yeah, sometimes they talk to other chaplains if they have one handy. When he was in Iraq, we only had regular U.S. mail contact, which took about 2 weeks to go back and forth. So he wrote me a lot. When he was deployed on a ship, we always had email access, so he would email back and forth quite a bit. So, you know, I'm probably his closest confidant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm wondering, some time ago we talked on this program with a journalist who served with a unit of Marines in Iraq, and they were the men who went in ahead of right at the very beginning of the invasion. Their job was to rush into Iraq, and one of the things that we talked about was the kind of counseling that these young men were looking for, what they needed. And somebody called and identified herself as a pacifist and wanted to know from the journalist how chaplains dealt with, you know, the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," and the message of the New Testament. And how does Frank deal with that? And I would imagine that the two of you have talked about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have. I mean, actually, as a pacifist, I can tell you there is no one right response, or as a Quaker, there's no one right response to the question of what do you do in a time of war. You know, there's a whole, in my own family, I had relatives in World War II who wound up going to prison rather than serve. I had others who served in non-combatant positions. For instance, they went in afterward to help rebuild in France and that sort of thing, but as a member of the military, you know, the conscientious objector. And there's a member of my meeting in Washington, D.C., who actually enlisted, who believed that protecting innocent life was the right thing to do as a Quaker. So there's a whole range of responses, and I'm not going to sit in judgment as to which is the right and which is the wrong response. And I think, you know, that's my husband's approach. Now, he would say that the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," actually, when properly translated, is "Thou shalt not murder." You know, there are others who would say that's splitting hairs, but there are many people who find comfort in that, that there is a time for taking up arms to, you know, defend yourself, your family, or to protect other innocent people. And I do hear that over and over again from the soldiers and Marines that I speak with, that, you know, even in Iraq, that they feel like they're doing the right thing and that they are protecting people who need protecting.
Hmm. Well, talking with this journalist, his name is Evan Wright, he said one of the things that the Marines were concerned about was not only killing civilians, which happened, mm-hmm. But also killing the enemy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That struck my husband. You know, he said as he was following the invasion up through Iraq to Baghdad, they passed through An-Nasiriyah right after that battle, which happened in the first couple of days of the war. And, you know, the windshield wipers on one truck were still ticking, you know, and the fires were still burning and the bodies were still there. And, you know, he saw the body of one, obviously a fighter, Iraqi fighter. And, you know, that guy had just been trying to kill people that he knew not too long before, and yet he looked at that body and thought, somebody loves him. You know, someone's going to wonder, you know, will they even get word that he's dead? Will they ever find out what happened to him? And so that kind of thing sort of, it does weigh on you.
Hmm. Kristen Henderson is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's a writer. She's a Quaker, a pacifist. She's married to a chaplain in the Navy. He shipped out with the Marines to Afghanistan after the terrorist attacks of September 11th. He has also served as a chaplain in Iraq. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest, Kristen Henderson, is the author of Driving by Moonlight, A Journey Through Love, War, and Infertility. The book is available from Seal Press, which is an imprint of Avalon. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. You wrote a piece a few months back for the Washington Post about homecomings. And in this piece, you report about how Frank advises sailors and Marines on coming home. Mm-hmm. And he says, have no expectations. Put your spouse's needs first. If you both do that, you can avoid most of the disappointments and fights.
Easier said than done.
Yeah. Well, you know what I thought of? I thought of, you know what, he might as well have said, you'll be driving by moonlight, guys.
Yeah, you know, and because you'll have expectations without even knowing you have expectations. My husband's been on 3 major deployments since he went in the service 6 years ago. He's been gone about half the time. The first one was a 6-month deployment to the Persian Gulf before September 11th. It was in 1999, so it was a peacetime deployment. And my biggest concern during that one, safety-wise, was that when he was helicoptering back and forth between ships, that the helicopter might go down. But I knew the chances were pretty slim. So my biggest fear was that we would grow apart because we'd never been apart that long. And, you know, I found I actually kind of liked being on my own, you know, and having him deployed was sort of like being single without having to date. It was great. I had all this freedom. And when he came back, fortunately, my fears were not realized. It was like a honeymoon. It was really, really nice. The time apart gave us time to appreciate each other, I think.
Yeah.
You know, all those little bickery habits you get into. And then his next deployment was the one right after September 11th. And so when he came back from that, I was expecting the same kind of honeymoon, and it wasn't. It was extremely rocky. Throwing things at each other, yelling, shouting, and at some point I thought, you know, we've been married 13 years at that point, and 14 years, and we have no children, no money problems, and if we're having this much trouble, how are those young families with, you know, children and financial pressures making it? And then when he went to Iraq, I knew when he came back from that his experiences there had been much more intense. And so that time I was expecting the worst. You know, I thought it would be worse than when he came back from Afghanistan. And, you know, to my surprise, he was downright mellow. And I think that Iraq experience really helped him. It really made him, it put life in perspective when you're, you know, living in the dirt and seeing how other people live and, you know, don't have all the comforts of home, and then you come back to this place that's so green and so air-conditioned and, you know, just getting ice in his water, he was grateful. And it just, he just decided he wasn't going to sweat the small stuff anymore.
Yeah. He felt a little guilt, though, as I understand it in what you wrote for the Post, that there were still Americans there, and there were still, of course, the Iraqis who were suffering through it all.
That's a pretty common reaction, particularly, you know, to this day he talks about wanting to go back. And I think that's just the sense that there are other people carrying your water for you, that, you know, your guys are over there and you want to be there to help and do your part.
Hmm.
Not that the experience itself was so uplifting.
Yeah.
But in some ways it is, too. I mean, studies have shown, and you talk to people who've been through combat experiences, and they'll say it was absolutely horrible and also the most amazing experience of their life, and they would do it again, and they're glad they didn't miss it. Partly because the bonds you make with the people you're with are so intense, and it's very unique. You don't find that kind of bond in our regular everyday life.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Muhammad on line one.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate the thoughtful approach of the author of the book. Like the previous caller, though, I think that the war in Iraq is unjust. The United States should not be there. If someone thinks that the war is unjust, or say if a chaplain were to come to that conclusion, would the chaplain then have a responsibility to persuade soldiers not to kill in that war? And, you know, you can address this question with respect to the war in Iraq or in a more general theoretical way, if you want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wonder how someone who takes seriously, say, the command to love your enemies and do good to those who abuse you, doesn't actually try to persuade people not to kill in a war that's obviously unjust. So I'd like you to address that question, please. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Well, that's a really good question. That's why I love these conversations, because they force me to work through things that are much easier to set aside. I think, as with any matter of principle, if a chaplain feels that way, then you know, that's a struggle in their own soul that they have to deal with, and you know, they are certainly entitled to do that, to try and convince people not to kill. They're very likely to be removed from service, but that's the choice they have to make. I mean, any time we take a stand on principle, we have to be prepared for the consequences. Like the people who marched in the civil rights marches, they were prepared to go to jail. So I think we have freedom to stand on principle at any time, but we also have to be prepared to take those consequences, whatever they are.
I thank the listener for that question. Other questions are invited, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Back to the Washington Post article and homecomings. At the outset of that article, you say the homecomings go on for months. In some ways, they go on for the rest of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Talk with us about that.
Well, they change us. You know, those of us, the wives and husbands who wait behind, are changed as well, and certainly our service members are changed when you come back. I mean, it's a pretty profound experience on every level, and so those changes stay with you. Sometimes they're for the better, sometimes it's a growing experience, and then of course there are cases of post-traumatic stress disorder. My husband has been fortunate not to have anything too major. He has a pronounced startle reflex. If he's working in his office here at home with his back to the door, I always say, I'm coming in when I walk in. I don't just walk up behind him, because if I surprise him, he just jumps out of his skin. And that just comes from, you know, being on alert so long. You know, and occasionally if there's thunder at night, in his dreams he thinks it's artillery. So that's a fairly minor consequence. But there are others who have, you know, much greater struggles to deal with. And the military has come a long way in its in being proactive and helping people deal with that. It still has a ways to go, but at least it's being acknowledged at this point.
Yeah. One of the things that surprised me, and I don't think it should have, it seems obvious, is that once he comes back, he has a couple of days off, and then he's back at work.
Yeah, actually, they try to keep them at work for the first week or so at least before they start sending them out on what they call block leave, where they get extended leave to visit family and that sort of thing. And that really helps with homecomings, because you need some sort of stable environment. You're throwing these family back together, and if you then immediately cut them loose to go off, I mean, if there were issues before the deployment, those issues will be there afterward. Plus, then you have the stress of having been apart and whatever each of them experienced during the separation. So it's really better for them to have some stability by having to go someplace to do a job that's familiar in a familiar environment, and then come home each day for a week or so to kind of get their bearings.
Yeah, but for a chaplain...
Yeah, for my husband, someone like my husband, actually, the job can be pretty busy. And it varies, again, from deployment to deployment. After Afghanistan, it was pretty busy right away, you know, Marines struggling with readjustment back into their regular lives, getting into fights and, you know, family issues and that kind of thing. But after Iraq, it took a little bit longer, but, you know, the same sort of issues came up again. It was a slightly different group of people, so... every unit's a little bit different. Some are more gung-ho. You know, your infantry combat units are more gung-ho than, say, your, you know, engineer battalion. So it just varies.
In today's military, of course, we have women serving.
Mm-hmm.
Women leaving husbands, sweethearts behind, do they have a similar experience of homecoming?
It seems to be pretty similar. I've been focused on the, you know, on the spouse's experience. And I've talked to some husbands, as well as, you know, the many, many wives. And, you know, it's a human experience more than it's a gender-specific experience of having a spouse over there and being concerned. I think for husbands whose wives are in Iraq or Afghanistan, what's unique to men is, of course, men have that protective instinct of wanting to, you know, jump out to physically protect their spouses, and they can't do it. And I think that that is, my understanding is that that is one of the hardest things for men to deal with. And also, as women, as wives, we tend to, our response to, you know, a stressful situation tends to be to reach out to other women and, you know, connect and kind of build a network. And it may be easier for husbands left behind to feel more isolated because that's not necessarily a male response.
Hmm. Another interesting thing in the article that was in the Washington Post, and I would suggest that if listeners are interested that they look for this at the library. It's from the Washington Post magazine, October 5th, 2003.
Yeah, actually, it's also a link to it from my website.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah, and in fact, I have another article coming out on a related subject coming out in November, which is about the wartime deployment experience from the point of view of the spouses left behind, kind of going through what a typical deployment's like, the emotional changes you go through, and just some of the challenges you face, because it's not necessarily obvious or apparent to people who haven't been through it.
Yeah. Another one of the things that I thought was interesting was kind of the ambivalence about, on coming home, about the flags, the yellow ribbons, mm-hmm. the fireworks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my husband experienced that, and not everyone does, but a lot of military service members who come home after being gone feel a certain alienation from the civilian population,
mm-hmm.
because they have, you know, they've come back from this environment where they put everything on the line. And, you know, it's just hard for them to relate sometimes to people who may be very well-intentioned, but, you know, have their form of patriotism is to wave a flag, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it can be hard for someone to relate to after they've, you know, been in such such an extreme situation in comparison.
Yeah. Well,
and it's not that they think that the people left behind are unpatriotic or that they look down on them. It's just simply as if they're living in different worlds. This is the sense of, I can't really connect with you.
Yeah, yeah. You want to, in way of wrapping things up this afternoon, Kristen, you want to say anything?
No, I just, I really appreciate having these opportunities to talk with folks, and, you know, it's much a process for me of learning, and, you know, we're just all on this road together trying to feel our way, so thanks to those who called in.
Yeah. Will there be a Driving by Moonlight too?
Now I'm actually kind of tired of writing about myself. There's only so much navel gazing anyone can take. But I am working on a new book, which is similar to the article I just talked about.
Uh-huh.
It's about the whole deployment experience, you know, and it kind of follows the experiences of several wives very closely, and the social workers and chaplains and other staff folks who work with them. Just kind of, it's a window on a world that most Americans are not aware of, and that'll be out in another year.
And where can we find your fiction?
There's not a lot of that. I've been sort of taken up with this whole nonfiction thing the last couple of years, but there are a couple of samples of it on my website as
Good.
Well.
Okay. And let's give that website again, and I'll spell it correctly this time. The website is www.Kristin Henderson, and that's Henderson with an O, henderson.com. And also there's a link to Kristen's website from our website here at WILL, and our website is WILL.UIUC.edu. Go to the afternoon, go to AM, then the afternoon magazine, and this week, and you'll find the website for Kristin Henderson. Kristin, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon and our listeners.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, and thanks for everyone for listening and for thinking about these things.
Well, take care.
Thanks.
Kristin Henderson has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Driving by Moonlight, A Journey Through Love, War, and Infertility, the book available from Seal Press, which is an imprint of Avalon. 10 minutes before 2 o'clock, and settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. At the Board of Trade, on the grains floor, everything was higher for the day. Futures in the wheat pit pushing up 7.75 cents in the nearby September contract, with a high at 318.5, a low at 310. Their settlement price at 317.5 was 7.75 higher for the day. December futures in the wheat pit, 331 the high, the low at 323. A settlement at 330.25. They were up 7.5 for the day. And the March contract finished the day like this: a 342 high, low at 333.5, settled at 341.25, up 8.25 on the day. May in the wheat pit, 344.5 the high, the low at 338, settled at 344.5. May futures up 7.25 cents. And July wheat up 7 cents for the day, had a high of 347.5, a low at 341, settled at 346.5. From the corn pit, the nearby September contract, 234 the high, the low at 228.5. Settlement there at 233.5, up 5.75. And December futures, 245 the high, low at 237.75. Settlement price at 242.75. They were up a nickel today. We'll talk with Paul Cooley at FADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time this afternoon to see exactly why this March higher is continuing. In the corn, 251.5 for the March contract, in fact, for the high, the low at 245.75. Settled at 251, up 5.75 for the day. May corn, 256.75 the high, the low at 251.75, settled 256.5, up 4.75. In July futures, 262 the high, the low at 256, settled 260.75, up 4.25. September contract, 265 the high, the low at 258, settlement price at 261.5, up 2 for the day. Hey, a couple of news stories on the corn that'll be out today and tomorrow. One, if you've got a Western corn rootworm BT-resistant corn in your field, go out and check it. We'll talk with Extension Ag entomologist Mike Gray tomorrow about that particular product. That's the Monsanto 863 event. There's only one event out there, and it is for all hybrids and all varieties of corn. If it's in your field, check it and listen in tomorrow to see what Mike Gray has to say about it. The next thing is Starlink. You've been waiting for a payment, possibly, or gotten a denial letter recently. You'll want to listen up this afternoon during the closing market report. I spoke with David Brower, who is the co-lead counsel on the class action lawsuit. Payments will be coming very soon, and they're bigger than you might expect. From the soy complex, now 648.5 is the high for the day in the September contract, the low at 624. A settlement price is 636.5 in the bean pit, up 9.25 cents for the September contract. Noves finished the day 10 higher, 652 the high, the low at 623. Settled in the November at 637.25, they were up a dime. January beans, 656 the high, the low at 631. Settlement price there at 644.25, up 11.25. In the March, 662 the high, the low at 636, settled at 649.75, up 11.25 for the day. May soybean, 658 the high, the low at 636, settlement at 648, up 8.25. And July futures settled 7 higher, 659 the high, the low at 642, and settled at 651 for July beans of next year. September bean meal, 190.50 the high, the low at 177, settled 181.10. They were up 30, and the October were up, or rather down a dime, had a high of 189, a low at 176.20, and settled 179.90 for the October bean meal. September bean oil, 26.82 high, low at 26.10. And a settlement price at 26.70. They finished 60 higher in the October contract, 26.25 the high, low at 25.75, a settlement at 26.23, and they finished the day 75 higher. Be sure to tune in this afternoon for the closing market report. All kinds of things, as we talked about, happening today. We'll talk with Paul Cooley and Kay Whitlock, as usual, and we'll hear about Starlink corn. Be sure to tune in. That's at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock. But first, we'll get the settlements from the Mercantile Exchange with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, Todd. Cattle finished lower today, while lean hogs and February bellies finished on the upside. September feeder cattle, the high today 111.60, the low 109.80, the settlement 110.15, that down 225. October 108.80, the high 106.80, the low 107, even the settlement, that down 242.5. November 107.85, the high 105.85, the low 106.32.5, the settlement, that down 210. October live cattle, 83.90, the high 82.45, the low 83.07.5, the settlement, that down 157.5. December live cattle, 86.90 the high, 85.40 the low, 86.40 the settlement, that down 105. October lean hog, 67.40 the high, 65.45 the low, finishing at 66.80, up 82.5. December, 64.40 the high, 62.85 the low, 64.37.5 the settlement, that up 65. February, 63.50 the high, 62.07.5 the low, the settlement 63.40, that up 90. April, 62.35 the high, 61.30 the low, 62.20 the settlement, that up 70. February bellies, 95.30 the high, the low 92.12.5, the settlement 95.15, that up 272.5. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 11 points at 10,163. The NASDAQ up 8 at 1846. And the S&P 500 up 1 point at 1105.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
John Kent from Troy, New York writes, "Dear Dr. Science, what is nougat, and does it have some sort of symbiotic relationship with its rich chocolate coating?"
Nougat is a reduced form of sugar that forms strong molecular bonds with chocolate. In doing so, it turns weak, flaccid chocolate into rich, dark, chocolatey nougat. Now, this isn't to be confused with actual rich, dark chocolate, which is only available to select Swiss bankers at their villas on Lake Como. Notice that candy manufacturers only refer to rich, dark chocolate taste. Well, this is akin to the difference between lemons and lemony taste, which are as far apart as a pig and a poke.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. For information about the new Dr. Science Get Smart Kit, including his new compact disc with screensaver for PCs and an honorary master's degree mouse pad, all for $21.95, call 800-989-DUCK.
Have you entered the WILL sweepstakes? You could win one of 10 major prizes for your home, each worth $1,000 or more. But time's running out. Your entry must be postmarked by September 6th to win the high-definition TV, the computer, or area rug. If you need an entry form, call WILL at 217-333-0850.
When Hurricane Charley struck, it brought tragedy to Southwest Florida. It also brought opportunity to businesses helping with the cleanup and to some con artists.
I just want to make sure that when they do the subcontracting, they're contracting to licensed people, and these people are on the payroll of a licensed contractor.
I understand.
That's what we're looking for.
Stopping Hurricane Profiteers, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Jason Croft is our technical director today, the producer for the